I'm very happy now to welcome Michael Northrup. He is the director of the Sustainable Development Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund in New York City. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Shirley.
So we've been talking all week about climate change and the economic and environmental and human consequences of not doing anything that we're already seeing and that we will see in much greater measure if we don't make some very big changes. And one of the biggest changes we're looking at in order to avert the worst crisis is massive investment in clean energy technologies and conversion to these technologies away from fossil fuels. So I was hoping that you could help us understand the relationship between government regulation and investment in clean technologies. In other words, what political conditions are necessary for investors to feel secure and willing to invest?
Right. Investors won't invest unless they feel they have a market that is sure. And right now they really don't feel that way about renewable energy in the United States. So that's a problem. And I guess the same would go if you were looking at efficiency markets. We don't have national standards on buildings. We don't have retrofit standards. And in the transportation sector, another big place where clean energy investment could take place, we really don't have enough of an incentive structure for large manufacturing to really build and operate plants in the United States. So it's true across all three of these areas, renewable energy, efficiency, and transportation.
So from the point of view of a venture capitalist who says, I want to do the right thing and I want to invest in, say, solar panels or mass transportation or improved grid efficiency, things like that, what do they want? What are they looking for? And where are they investing?
Well, and more people are investing in other countries because there seems to be more momentum in other parts of the world. Notably China. China's really decided to move forward very rapidly on these issues. And 5 years ago, China didn't have any manufacturing capacity to speak of in the solar or the wind sectors, and now they are producing more wind turbines and solar cells than any other country in the world. You look at places like Europe, it's also happening. There's a great story in the New York Times this week about Portugal, which in 5 years has increased its renewable energy generation from 17% to 45% of total energy generated. It's remarkable what can happen in a short time if you have the right structure in place. In Europe and in China, in the renewable energy space, the tactic that people have employed that seems to be working that we have yet to catch on to is creating a guaranteed purchase contract for renewable energy so that if you're generating power by wind or solar or thermal or biomass, whatever, there's an added increment of price that you can get for your production in order to make sure that it's competitive for you. In Europe, they call it, it's a terrible name, they call them feed-in tariffs, which I think would be a no-go in the United States as a terminology. We'll have to invent another term. But in essence, they're long-term purchase contracts that allow producers to know that they have a stable market. And that means an investor knows that they have a stable market to invest in. It means that a bank can give a loan to an investor in order to build a manufacturing plant. Right now, we live year to year with an investment tax credit structure in the United States that seems to run out, and then there's a kind of a six-month hiatus while Congress decides to renew it or not. It's a horrible situation for a big company trying to invest in building manufacturing plant or trying to hire people to take on the jobs inside those plants. And this is just misery for the U.S. in terms of, you know, building a renewable energy industry in the future.
When you say long-term guaranteed purchase contracts, help us understand that contract. Who is the contract between and what does it say?
You know, there are many, many ways to do this. So anything I say could be tweaked and improved on, I'm sure. But typically, a utility will allow a small business or a household or a wind generator at a larger scale to manufacture power using wind and will pay them a price that's competitive for that wind. The same would happen in solar or biomass or geothermal or any other technology. And the idea is that that can then be sold into the grid in a way that is economic for the producer. And then that cost is taken on board by the entire rate-paying community inside that utility system. And if you design these things right, it actually adds, you know, really small incremental expenses to any individual's utility bill. And then that small increment of cost spread out over a larger utility customer base can actually pay for a large quantity of power to come into the system that is from renewable energy sources. So Vermont chose last year to do this and enacted a purchase contract system for a variety of renewable energies and chose the number 50 megawatts of power that they wanted to be brought into the system. They estimate that it will be a 1% increase in customers' bills over the course of the year, which, you know, is some people might yell and scream about that, but it actually, you know, is also an investment in jobs and manufacturing in Vermont, which means that in a state that really does need jobs and new business opportunities, all of those are beginning to flock to the state in really remarkable new ways. There was a little city in Florida, Gainesville, Florida. Only 110,000 people in Gainesville. The former mayor, Begin Hanrahan, put in place a small feed-in tariff for solar in her community, but small in relative terms. They actually, in the first year of the program, put online three times as many megawatts of solar power in Gainesville than existed in the entire state. So clearly the policy structure that had been in place was not functioning as well as people would have liked. Policies really do make a difference. I think we could learn a lot from these European techniques to try to bring more of this stuff online and also generate jobs and manufacturing and business enterprises at the same time.
So the tax credit structure that we have tried, or those experiments, have been very weak, not very useful. You talked about these long-term guaranteed purchase contracts. What about the thing that we're considering here in New Mexico, a carbon cap, or cap and trade, or cap and dividend? How do these types of structures affect the possibility of investment?
Well, each of those policies you just mentioned are open to all kinds of interpretation. But at its essence, what a cap would do would be to make sure that only a certain amount of carbon is generated through the utility process, which would mean that the remainder would have to be generated using other forms of clean energy. And, you know, what happens in order to create the incentive so that the pricing structure works for the clean energy generators is the trick. So I think it's a really good thing. What caps are designed to do, cap and trade, cap and dividend, or just a cap, is to actually send a price signal to the market that says that carbon is more expensive than it is in an unregulated market. And if that's the case, then the price of carbon in a dirty fuel goes up, making other forms of renewable energy more cost competitive. And so price signals are exactly the kinds of things that we should be enacting all across the country. Carbon taxes and other mechanisms to do the same thing. We tend to think carbon taxes are not as politically palatable in the United States because of the tax word. And that's why people have tried to figure out a way to make this cap and trade system work in Washington. But that also seems to have really backfired in the last several months, unfortunately.
One of the things that I think is important just to mention here, and this is a term that you use in some of the articles that you've written, is that it's very important to have science-based legislation. In other words, you can't really compromise when a limit is set by the gigantic vast majority of scientists who are looking at this, at the numbers. For example, we talked yesterday to Bill McKibben, who talked about the 350 parts per million limit. Why do you think that the United States has not really embraced the science of global warming in the political process?
One, it's been hard for people to take on board the seriousness of the issue. There's no doubt about that. It is hard to understand it unless you're a scientist. And the problem seems to have been getting worse as we've been talking about it more seriously. I remember, you know, in 2005 when Tony Blair suggested that we could get the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom said that, you know, what we really needed was a 50% cut in emissions by 2050 in order to make the worst case scenario of climate change not come true. Scientists now think that it's actually sped up the warming in the atmosphere to a degree that they had not imagined. And so they're now saying, well, you know, we need an 80% cut by 2050. Some people are saying we need, you know, even more than that. And it makes it even more difficult to take on board. So there is those goalposts are moving. There's a lack of kind of comprehension of the seriousness of this. And then there's a very well-organized, well-funded set of status quo interests who are doing just fine, thank you, you know, generating power using coal and other dirty fossil fuels, who feel that their way of life and their economies are threatened if we do anything to change that. And so they're resisting like mad. And unfortunately, they are extremely well-funded and deep-pocketed. And, you know, if a politician has one political interest to be concerned about in their jurisdiction, it's often the utility. So if utilities are not really pushing for this, it makes it much harder. And most utilities are not pushing for this. In fact, they're really fighting hard to make sure that we don't go in this direction and create this kind of change. So it's a pretty tough situation for an advocate for the significant kind of change that we're talking about. Change is always scary. And in this situation, it's, you know, particularly scary, and it's not even understood. And people are saying that the people who are calling for these changes are, you know, all kooks and nuts. And they're very organized about saying that, which puts a lot of doubt in people's heads. So it's a tough situation, unfortunately.
We're talking to Michael Northrup. He's the director of the Sustainable Development Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund in New York City. So you have been talking about, you use the term in one of your articles, clean energy gold rush. And the United States is way behind. As you mentioned, China and other countries are far ahead in claiming those markets. What are those markets? What falls under the category of clean energy in this gold rush?
Well, people have assumed that this was a big market. And then last fall, the big global multinational bank, HSBC, came out with a report, which I found staggering. They looked around the world to try to figure out how big this clean energy sector was and came up with a just absolutely amazing number. They counted a $500 billion annual market for clean energy. About 75% of that was generation, about a quarter of it was efficiency, and there's some miscellaneous in there too. So it's all the things we're talking about. And it's a market segment that's bigger than the global aerospace or defense sectors combined. It's really big, and there aren't too many of these out there. So they said that in 2009 it had already reached a $500 billion a year level. And they predicted, after a lot of analysis, and I think it's right, that in 10 years, by 2020, in 10 years, that marketplace will be $2 trillion a year. So there'll be three more of these $500 billion market segments out there. Now, you look at the United States now in its somewhat wounded economic state. Boy, you know, wouldn't it be great for us to be vying for that marketplace and trying to take advantage of it? And it is really striking how fast places like China have begun to move on this, and some of the Europeans as well, like the Portuguese example I mentioned earlier, a small country. But, you know, the Germans and the UK are doing the same thing. Many other European countries are as well. We should be jumping for those markets. This is the future economy the United States should be owning. We use 25% of the world's energy. Think of 25% of $2 trillion. It would be one of those $500 billion market segments. And we should be owning that. And if we really are the manufacturing powerhouse that we think we are, we should be owning more than that. And unfortunately now, we don't have a national goal. We don't have a national policy, really, to even do this. We have none of the incentive systems that could really take this on in a big way. You know, you just look at the manufacturing segments in this space. You know, in wind, we have one of the 10 largest wind manufacturers in the world in the United States, and that's General Electric. We have two of the 10 largest solar manufacturers in the world, but both of them do most of their manufacturing in China. And we're nowhere on in the other segments. You know, if we're going to really own these manufacturing segments and generate the jobs and the income and the dividends from this gigantic economic development opportunity, we've really got to get started or we're going to fall behind. And not only will we be shipping our oil dollars to the Middle East, we'll be shipping all our wind and solar dollars to China, too. And that's just unacceptable. We just have to say as a country we're going to do something about this and put these structures in place.
So basically, if I understand all of this correctly, what it looks like is a country, whether it be the United States or somebody else, institutes public policy that is conducive to clean energy development and efficiency. Then that makes it conducive for companies to invest huge, almost incomprehensible amounts of money in clean energy. And then we can get off fossil fuels. And the only reason we don't do this is because the fossil fuel lobbies are too strong and we don't have campaign finance reform.
Yeah, campaign finance reform is going to make it even more difficult now when you think of the kinds of money that the oil and coal industries have poured into stopping Senate action on global warming this year. You know, and you think about the most recent Supreme Court ruling that, you know, really allows now for unlimited campaign contributions by private interests, it's going to be even tougher to move this ball down the court. So it's worrisome. I guess what we need to count on is that people will wake up to the things that Bill McKibben is saying about the urgency of this situation. In the middle of a summer where we are seeing fires in Russia and heat waves that they've never seen before and floods in Asia and all kinds of other natural phenomenon that are the kinds of things that are going to get produced by a warming world, you know, it is just insane that we're not connecting the dots, getting more worried and putting these policies in place that will allow us to become, you know, the giant engine for the clean energy marketplace of the future.
You lecture part of the time at the Yale University Forest and Environmental Studies School. For all of my life, there's been a really, I guess you would say, uneasy relationship between commerce and environmentalism. They're kind of pitted against each other, and part of that is real, and part of it is the media, but there's this kind of mythology that what's good for the environment is bad for business and vice versa. That seems to be ingrained in American culture. Right now, from what you're saying, we're looking at a very different picture where if we follow the pure capitalist direction of stimulating the greatest amount of investment in this huge market, we're actually helping the environment.
Yeah, it's people have said this for a long time, and many have chosen not to believe it, but it really is so clear to me now that the greatest incentive for building a vibrant economy in the United States right now is the climate change imperative. You know, and what an interesting, you know, situation to have found ourselves in. You see now people catching on to that, like HSBC and Deutsche Bank and, you know, other big investors who are now out saying, this is our future, guys. Let's get it together. Stop this bipartisan wrangling. Meeting our obligations to the planet is the same as meeting our obligations to our economy. We've just got to be doing this. You know, I'm heartened as I look around the country now by people who are from kind of the economic development community who are catching on to this and recognizing that climate change is the biggest economic opportunity they've seen in their lifetimes. There's a, you know, there's a real contrast between what you hear from the National Chamber of Commerce in Washington, which tends to be very, very kind of knee-jerk anti-anything that sounds like it's environmental, and a lot of their brethren at the local and state levels around the country who are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, this is a big opportunity. Let's get on board. Let's figure out a way to do this stuff and get this money into our local economies the way Pagin Hanrahan in Gainesville, Florida has, and the way politicians and economic developers in Vermont have, and certainly the way, you know, leading states like California have. But people are beginning to catch on, and you do hear it more and more from mayors and from governors who actually have the hands-on empirical experience of trying to do these kinds of quote-unquote climate change policies or clean energy policies, they keep finding that they're getting jobs and savings and all kinds of other benefits from doing so as well. So, you know, it often takes a while in this very large country for that kind of information to filter from the local and state level into the federal policy arena. It seems to be taking especially long as we kind of watch the urgency of climate change develop. But, you know, I am heartened by what I see happening at the local and state level around the country, and I do think that voices of reason from those levels are going to transcend the sort of partisan bitterness and say, hey, come on, let's just get practical and get on with this and stop the fighting and let's just do it and build our economy while we do so.
Well, you're in New York and you work with business people and bankers at the highest level. I mean, does the business community that you interact with have any idea of how urgent the situation is and what the timeline is?
I think some do. I mean, they've got their own urgent timeline, which is often a quarterly timeline, so it's hard to focus on things too far afield sometimes. But you do see it. I mean, there's a remarkable network of investors and businesses that has been operating under a banner called the We Can Lead campaign. You know, they have better things to do. They all need to run their businesses, but they have actually come together to say, please, 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 federal lawmakers, stop the bitter wrangling. Let's get on board and do something about this because this is our future. And, you know, they are so concerned about it, they've actually been traveling into Washington, D.C. to meet with senators and congressmen. You know, that's another one of those good signs of kind of local good sense just rising up and going to Washington to kind of shake people up and say, come on, let's do something real here and do the right thing. So I am seeing more and more interest in the private sector along these lines. Just, you know, it's been a little bit hard the last 2 years with the economy in shambles for people to be doing it everywhere in the American business community. But I do think that this We Can Lead effort by businesses in, at last count, something like 40 states is really a great harbinger of what I think we'll see more and more of, particularly as the economy hopefully picks up some steam and people get a little bit more time to think about things outside of escaping bankruptcy proceedings and other bad things during this horrible economic time.
Michael Northrup is the director of the Sustainable Development Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund in New York City. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hey, thanks, Mary Charlotte. Real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we're going to take another quick little break right now. Please stay tuned. John Fogarty will be back for the last couple of minutes of the show.